Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. And today I'm very pleased to have as my guest the very brilliant Benjamin Moser, who is the author of two biographies of women writers. The first was a biography of Clarice Lispector, which did a good deal of bringing Lispector, a writer who spent a good majority of her life in Brazil, to the attention of American readers. And the second is a biography of Susan Sontag, her life and work, which has been a controversial book, as if a biography could be controversial. But nevertheless, this is the way it seems. Now, what do you think of the controversy that seems to have surrounded this book?
Well, I think a book about Susan Sontag that wasn't controversial would not be a book about Susan Sontag. I think she's somebody who elicited very heavy, very visceral, and sometimes violent opinions all through her life. And I don't really see it as controversial, this book. I see it more as just, I hope, as something starting a conversation about an author that I think is more essential than ever. I mean, Sontag was always associated with fashion. She was associated with photography. She was associated with being on the cover of Vanity Fair and the only possible American intellectual who could have been on the cover of Vanity Fair. I think the real writers that we actually care about are the ones who go on after their deaths and who have these chances to be reevaluated.
I can remember the first time I read Susan Sontag's first book, which was Against Interpretation. Can you remember the first time you read it?
Against Interpretation?
Yes.
Yeah, I can, because I actually hadn't read it until I started working on this book.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. No, I had read the photography stuff mainly, and then I had read essays from Against Interpretation. I think I hadn't read the whole book. I'd read Notes on Camp. I'd read the title essay. I'd read some of the film essays. But what was really exciting about going back to read it now is that you see a world. You see this time, which is quite, again, it feels contemporary, but it's almost 60 years old, you know, Against Interpretation. But you get this whole panorama of culture and of ideas that feels very exciting to me.
I have to tell you, it was the first of her books that I read. I was astonished by it because of the enormity of range of what she's read. I mean, just when she makes a list of the books that she thinks of, you think, oh my, you'd already read that in the early 60s?
She was only in her early 30s, too. She was 30 when that book came out.
Before it became fashionable to have read Artaud, Susan cared about Artaud. And in fact, you know, she seems to know that the time she's living in, as opposed to the time she died in, was a time when people new things. I slivered out some quotes from Susan. Let's hear Susan.
People want to be moved. I, as a writer, want to move people. I was very moved, cried even a couple of passages that I was writing. There's one line that made me laugh grimly, where I want to say I say, but I don't feel it's me. I feel it's the book. The book says, It was a time when knowledge was fashionable, philistinism was unfashionable. And I wrote that line with a great deal of glee and grimness, because the time we live in is a time in which knowledge is unfashionable and philistinism is very fashionable.
I'm talking to Benjamin Moser, Sontag's biographer. That, what you just heard, was the very first time I sat face to face with Susan. That was from our first conversation. And you consider deeply the subject of knowledge and philistinism. And Susan's almost desire to attack the Philistines. Can you talk to me about that?
I think it's really funny. I think it's one of the great American questions. I think we're living in a time when Philistinism seems triumphant. We don't have to name names, but I think we all know who I'm talking about. And I think that there's a kind of feeling that we're always being engulfed by the gold escalator and all the things that in her lifetime were symbolic of middle browism, whether it was Life magazine and the Book of the Month Club or elevator music, all these kind of things. Sontag always stood for the opposite of all of that crap.
Now, you seem to think she becomes, as she lives longer and longer, harder and harder on the people around her. Tell me what you mean. Tell me what that means.
A lot of it might have had to do with the fact that she was physically ill a lot of her life. When she was 42, she got stage 4 breast cancer, and it almost killed her. And she was subjected to this very gruesome and horrifying treatment that did end up saving her life. And that's in 1975 to 78. So she's in her mid-40s by then. And it seemed to me that something did change in her, where she got more impatient, she got more intolerant of certain people. But I think that it's something that's interesting to try to understand what happens, but then not dwell on it too much, because what I'm really interested in Sontag, and what I think makes her relevant, is her writing and her ideas.
I think, though, that what we're talking about is the person who wrote in the introduction to Against Interpretation that we need an erotics of art, not a hermeneutics of art.
Right.
And she writes about her fondness for the Supremes, which at that time, you take someone, well, take any number of someones, whether it's Irving Howe or Saul Bellow, they're not listening to the Supremes. They find it to be quite a surprise that a highly thought of intellectual is talking about the Supremes. By the end of her life, she's not talking about the Supremes anymore, and she's not talking about neurotics of criticism.
No. Well, I think it's very important, again, to think about how old a lot of this is. You know, this is, again, it's more than 50 years ago. In that time and in that milieu, it was really shocking, and it's absolutely hilarious to see the reactions that she got. Because the thing about the Supremes, it's not like she wrote about the Supremes. She says something about how she liked the Supremes in one line.
That's it, yes.
No, but it followed her whole life.
But you point out very well and intelligently and correctly in this book that cultural conservatism has very little to do with political conservatism.
Well, this is another idea that I think has been forgotten. Sontag comes out of a world where, or out of an education where, what she means as small C conservatism is starting off with Plato and Aristotle and going up through Dante and Shakespeare and through the great modern poets, and that sort of that syllabus, that canon, that became extremely unfashionable. And now I think we're in a world where people aren't reacting against Beethoven. You know, they don't even know who Beethoven is, or Dante, or Shakespeare. And so both the people who wanted to modernize that and expand it, for example, to feminist or African-American authors, those people lost out just as much as the people who wanted it closed for political reasons from the right wing. And what happens, and that Sontag is very perceptive about time and time again, is that it all loses out to money. It all loses out to consumerism. And so what happens is, you know, a great painting becomes an expensive painting. A great song becomes a song that gets a lot of play on the radio or a lot of clicks on the internet. And that's the thing we're in now.
I'm talking once again to Benjamin Moser, Susan Sontag's biographer, in a book from Echo called Sontag. Do you think that you're writing a biography of Susan, or in addition, a biography of her times?
Well, I think both. You know, the book is called Sontag, Her Life and Work, and those are two things that are complementary, but there's a lot I'd like people to remember that people don't remember. People don't remember, for example, that it was quite common for women to write their husbands' books, as happened to Sontag.
Common?
Yes.
I'm fascinated.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Well, I didn't either. I've inhabited this world of the great female intellectuals, having done Clarice Lispector before and then Sontag. It's a world of that generation of my grandparents, my grandmother's generation, that I'm familiar with. And so about 3 months ago, this piece came out in The Guardian announcing that I had discovered that Sontag had actually written the book upon which her husband's career was based, a book called Freud, The Mind of the Moralist. And this piece went viral. Everybody was talking about it, and there was all sorts of comments, and everybody was totally outraged, and they couldn't believe it. And all these older women who are colleagues of Sontag's from Chicago or Harvard or her generation, they all wrote me, and they said, are you kidding? This happened to everybody. You know, nobody, why are people so surprised? And the reason they're surprised is that I think feminism has made so many gains that people have forgotten what it was like. So when you're talking about a history of her life and times, you know, when she applied, she was a very brilliant student, and she comes into the working world, and she applies for a job at a magazine. And her friend, a male friend, says, well, the fact that you're a woman is a real problem, but we're going to try to help them get over that. And that was a totally normal thing to say to a woman at that time. Now you would get sued, and, you know, rightly so. A lot of the ideas that we think are stable in our culture, whether you think about the position of African Americans, whether you think about the position of women or homosexuals or all these other things, they've changed really radically. And one of the things I think a book like the biography of Susan Sontag can do is trace the evolution of these ideas. So that's the part that I find fascinating, because sometimes she's ahead of things and sometimes she's behind and sometimes she's struggling to understand new ideas as they come into the world. It's a fascinating story.
Well, Susan, you know, comes of age in the city where this show is produced, Los Angeles. She goes first to Berkeley, I think for a year, and then to the University of Chicago. Within a week of meeting him, she marries one of her professors, and it's his book that she is said to have written. Now, how did you become convinced that that was the case? Because it's been said.
She said it to a lot of people. I mean, this was part of her drama of separating from her husband at a time when this was very difficult to do for all sorts of reasons, particularly because she was gay and because she was having a relationship with another woman. And this was something that I think people have also forgotten, that until the 1990s in this country, you could lose your child for being gay. And that happened quite often. And so she signs away the rights to this book in order to keep her child, which is a pretty creepy reality, but it was a reality. I became convinced right down the street in the UCLA archives, seeing her writing from the time and interviewing a lot of people who knew her both in Chicago and in Cambridge, and who saw her writing the book and knew it was her book. And this was the story that she told always. And the thing that really convinced me, I think, was just reading this book. If you know Susan's voice, and if you know her writing as well as the biographer ends up knowing her voice, it's obviously her. And he, Philip, her husband, wrote one more book, and that was it. And this is just clearly Sontag's voice. And so I believe her when she says that.
I met her around the time that The Volcano Lover was published. I said to her, could we be friends? And Susan looked at me with what people who know her would call her zany look, and said, could we be friends? And I thought, uh-oh. And she said, we are friends already. We've waited a long time. From now on, when I come here, I will spend all my free time with you, and I hope when you come to New York, you will with me too. Well, was I lucky? Because you see, if you went to New York to see Susan, after I went with her to her doctor's office, which was most days, we'd cross the street to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. She knew of a case where the curators would put objects that they were unsure about. She said, look at this and tell me everything you think. Was I scared? I was scared silly. After I told her what little I thought, we went upstairs to see the Bruegel exhibit. It was drawings. It was thrilling. Then we went to a rehearsal of a puppet theater that was performing with a string quartet, and the puppets were doing an adaptation of one of Heinrich von Kleist's plays. And then I believe the Italian brothers who made films, the Taviani brothers, they were showing a film of theirs that wasn't commonly seen in America at the Museum of Modern Art. And I'm asking you to just believe me, but I'm sure you've heard stories like this. We went across the street to the Donnell Library, where they had refurbished a print of Susan's movie Promised Lands. Boy, was it crowded with people who were just sitting eager to attack Susan's point of view about Israel and didn't even see that the point of view they were expecting to find wasn't in the movie. So as you wrote this book, it seems to me that a whole array of attitudes towards Susan Sontag crossed your mind. Enter and leave and enter again. How did you decide how to regard Susan Sontag?
Well, it's a great question, and it's really hard because Susan, as I said, always created around her and had projected onto her these very intense opinions. So people who sat down the table from her in 1972 hated her for life, even though she probably never even spoke to them. And other people worshipped her. And Sontag becomes, from the time she's very young, but particularly because she's so beautiful and because she's known to be gay, a magnet for women, and especially lesbians, but not only, who look to her as a role model. And on the other hand, you had people who absolutely hated her, and they still hate her.
And what's more, you say that it's her best film, and it is.
Well, I love that film, actually.
It's a very good film.
I think that it's, as someone who has always been active, or I try to be active, both as a Jew and as a pro-Palestinian person, I've always felt that that balance is very hard to find. It's very hard for people to understand that you can be in favor of the Jews and in favor of Israel and also be in favor of the Palestinians and their cause. And those are two compatible things and not two antagonistic things. But that's a very typical thing about Susan Sontag, is that she was able to see more than one perspective on things. And so people projected a lot of certainty onto her. I mean, she looked very majestic. You know, she was very, she had these famous pronouncements about things. But actually, when you look at her work and you actually read it and look at it, there's a lot more open to discussion than people might think. They think, oh, Susan hated this or she loved that. And almost always you say, yeah, but there's a quote from her, the nature of thinking is but. And she's often thinking, and she's often thinking against herself or along with herself, and her opinions do evolve.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Benjamin Moser about his new book, Sontag, Her Life and Work. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. And I'm talking with Benjamin Moser about his new book, Sontag, Her Life and Work, a portrait of a 20th century American intellectual and high culture connoisseur. One of the best things you do in the book is to ask readers to see that tragedy involves the confronting of imposing and very difficult points of view. That drama may be simple, but tragedy is frequently unlitigatable.
Well, tragedy is two rights, whereas drama is, you know, this is right her definition, is right versus wrong. So that's why Israel and Palestine is a great example. These are people who are both right, and they're caught in this deathly embrace. But that's also often true with, I think, the most interesting, for me, theme in the book, which is the war between metaphor and reality, the war between image and person. This book has a picture of Susan Sontag on the cover, and that is a picture of Susan Sontag. It's not actually her. On the other hand, it is her. I mean, she is the person represented there.
Let's face it. Our greatest writer in the English language is Shakespeare. No one argues about this, but he's also our greatest creator, as William Gass points out in many different essays, our most elaborate creator of complex metaphors. Why is Susan so opposed to metaphor? What is the difference between Susan's use of metaphor and the beauty of metaphor as used in the greatest of poetry?
The traditional objection to metaphor is the Platonic objection to metaphor and the Aristotelian, which is that it is not the thing. So if you say, as Susan did once, this road is straight as a string, you don't need to say as a string, you say the road is straight. That's just more of a copy edit question. I think when you look at what metaphor does in a political sense, which is that it can distort things. So metaphor in the general sense of corrupted language. So when you have the language that Trump uses, for example, which is it's lies, but he's actually quite good at creating elaborate metaphors that are catchy, you know, like fake news or the 12 angry Dems or whatever. You know, it's a way of distorting reality that is susceptible to misuse by political tyrants. I mean, that's the old Greek objection to it. And that's also Susan's objection.
Though, the idea that Plato offers that a well-painted rose can draw a bee.
Yes. And it can.
And it can. And, can it?
Well, yeah, maybe. Sontag worked herself into a real lather about this at some phases. And it's fascinating to see, for example, her outrage at photography, which is that it's showing something, it's a representation of something that isn't the same thing. And she feels very strongly that this is something that can be abused and that this actually can kill people. There's these famous, from the beginning of photography, there's a series of famous images from the Civil War and the Crimean War and all the way through World War II of staged war images. And these images are used as propaganda in order to create the conditions to continue a war that whose consequence will be that people will die. And that's, I think, the line she's always trying to emphasize, that it's not just Rose or this. It's something that really ends up breaking people's bodies.
Well, I want to say something maybe a little bit weird.
Go ahead.
But it must have been heartbreaking to Susan that she was so beautiful. Because it wasn't open to question. She was beautiful. Whether you're looking at photographs of her or she's being caught in a movie, she was beautiful. She was stunning. And yet, beauty is a metaphor.
Yeah.
Beauty becomes a metaphor to the extent that toward the end of her life, she would say to me, I was very beautiful, you know. And I didn't know how to respond. I would say, Susan, to me, you're beautiful still. You're a fascinating-looking person. I would rather be sitting facing you and be peering into the depths of your eyes and trying to avoid their accusative glare back. I'd rather be with you than practically anyone else. And Susan, I think, this is just, pardon me, I think Susan didn't want to be a metaphor.
No, she wanted to be a real person.
Benjamin Moser, who is my guest, is the author of a 710, page biography before the notes.
Something like that, yeah.
A biography of Susan Sontag. And I knew Susan quite well. I was honored to be able to read some of her manuscripts before she'd finished them. I was one of the people, you mentioned them in your book, who she could sit and write with me in the room.
Right.
What an incredible experience that was. I have to say that I loved her. Annie, who I interviewed after Susan was dead, said, "Did you stay in touch? Were you close to Susan until the end of her life?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "You must miss her terribly." And the answer is horribly. I miss her horribly, and I miss her still. So I want to thank you for having given us such a rich, sumptuous treatment of Susan. All the things, and I mean all of them, that people are saying about this book, positive and negative, all of them are true. That's the pleasure of the book. You never met her or spoke to her.
I never saw her.
Let's hear Susan's voice one more time before we close.
Still, I want to insist on the euphoria that there was in finding a voice for this because, we know from art, you know, it can present the most gruesome things, but there's a kind of elation. The feeling of being a world devourer, mm-hmm. you know, that you actually can sort of take it all in and give voice to it. I mean, my model at times was a musical model or even more specifically an operatic model that you could just stand stage front and center and belt it out and say, I long, I love, I fear, I dread, I want to die, I want to live, I protest.
Susan Sontag, I'm talking to Benjamin Moser, author of Sontag, Her Life and Work, published by Echo. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Great to see you.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I'm grateful to Kimberly Burns. I felt that because I'm quoted quite a few times in this book, that it was perhaps inappropriate for me to interview its author. I'm very happy to have had as my guest Benjamin Moser. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Benjamin Moser is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.